Welcome everyone to episode 3 of Buzz IT Talk, the podcast where we talk buzzwords and the latest trends within the tech industry, with the goal of helping businesses and decision makers go beyond the buzz. This is your host, David Weaver. I had the opportunity to speak with Jeff George from RGL Forensics and Joshua McDougall from Duff & Phelps on the topics of blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies. It was actually our first telephone interview here on the podcast. All my other interviews were face-to-face, and I'm happy to report that there were no technical issues and we were able to get some quality sound for the recording for you guys. In this episode, aside from covering some general definitions for blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies, we looked at some practical examples for the use of these currencies, as well as some issues surrounding these emerging assets. Josh and Jeff also have some tips for how people using cryptocurrencies can stay safe and also provide some insights on how to avoid Ponzi schemes. So without further ado, here is my interview with Jeff George and Joshua McDougall. All right, today on Buzz IT Talk, we are going to be discussing probably the biggest buzzword in the tech space for 2018, blockchain technology. And when you hear that term, blockchain, the buzzword that typically comes in the same breath or in the next sentence is more often than not cryptocurrency, or maybe even more likely bitcoins. So our goal today is to create a better understanding of these emerging assets and look at some of the issues these technologies bring to the market, as well as perhaps some untapped potential. And I have to be honest, I certainly missed the boat on the whole cryptocurrency scene, but I'm lucky to have two experts in the space on the show today. And so I'm probably set to learn a lot myself in this interview. And I hope that you listeners out there can also learn a few things from Jeff George and Joshua McDougall. Jeff, Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time to be on the show and for the interview. I really appreciate it. Jeff George is the director for the forensic accounting firm RGL Forensics. And Josh McDougall is director global data risk at Duff & Phelps, as well as the director at the Cryptocurrency Certification Consortium. But I think it's best that you guys take over from here with the introductions. Maybe you can tell the audience a little bit about yourselves and most importantly, how you have become involved in the cryptocurrency and blockchain space. And maybe, Jeff, would you like to start?
Thank you for the introduction. So yeah, I am a forensic accountant and we specialize in fraud investigations, uncovering Ponzi schemes, and we do a lot of economic damage quantification. And I've probably been in the cryptocurrency space about a year and a half or so and blockchain more recently. The main reason for me was as you are uncovering fraud or tracing assets or things like that, when you start to realize that cash that goes into a bank is no longer cash. It's, you know, electronic, it's digital currency. You probably want to figure out and understand that, since that's what the cases that are going to be coming through the pipeline now with the way people interact digitally in the world today in commerce. So a little bit of background on myself and Josh.
Great. Josh McDougall. I'm from Duff & Phelps, where our group handles a lot of cybersecurity consulting and digital investigations, helping with the seizure of assets in a proper manner, then working through those, be it, you know, something as kind of simple as an email account or something as complex as a new digital ledger situation. Mm-hmm. I've been in the cryptocurrency space for maybe 6, maybe 7 years now, starting with just finding Bitcoin itself fascinating, and then moving to figure out how we can help, which is where we started the Cryptocurrency Certification Consortium, also known as C4. Mm-hmm. It's just a nonprofit standard body in the space that does the certified Bitcoin professional designation and the cryptocurrency security standard, a standard used by most of the exchanges globally.
All right. Great. Again, nice to have you guys on the show. And I think it'd be good to jump right into our topic now, cryptocurrencies and blockchains. To me, it seems like someone decided to give value to the equivalent of monopoly money, and lots of people bought into it, but I'm sure that is a false perception, and there's definitely more to the story than that, so it'd be great to address some general terminology. What are cryptocurrencies? What are blockchains, and why do they exist?
Sure. So, I mean, the funny part of your example is that monopoly money, in a very specialized instance, is something that we give value towards in the same way.
Right.
In the scope of the game of Monopoly, we take that, we trust that money as you know, an actual asset to be used. Bitcoin is an interesting concept, and a lot of people have trouble with the fact that it has value kind of out of thin air by most people.
Right. Yeah.
But in really, when you take a look at what money is, it's just kind of a collective abstraction layer that just makes our lives easier. The barter system is great up until a certain point, but it turns out it's a lot easier in a large society to have a more generic method to transfer amongst each other.
Right.
I think one thing that's interesting when you look at this topic, I think the U.S., United States, it's tough to understand the full realm of cryptocurrency and things like that. You know, one of the big features is when you have these peer-to-peer verified networks is that in countries where societies and individuals do not trust their banks to hold their money, you now have a currency that they think is less manipulative. Also, if you have a government that you don't trust to regulate your currency and to value, you know, the value, yes, people think cryptocurrency is volatile, but that's something that they think they can understand more than somebody individual manipulating their currency. So, you know, the value, you know, when you look at the rest of the world, you know, people are like, why is there any value in this certain cryptocurrency or things like that? You know, having it decentralized and having it not regulated by a certain government is a huge value to people in other countries. So,
okay, so maybe you can touch on that not regulated part a little bit. What is it about these? How do these cryptocurrencies then work? What is it? Yeah, go ahead.
So, an interesting thing is that you can look at cryptocurrencies in one way and see them as completely non-regulated, and in a way that's accurate, and then you can see it as a set of standards that a community follows, which would be similar to regulation, but it's a kind of a community effort to develop what those standards and practices are. So when you're a node on the Bitcoin network, or another word, as a user on the Bitcoin network, you're following the same standards and practices that everyone else on that node is believing in. Now, those standards and practices dictate how cryptography is used to trust each movement that's taking place. But when it comes down to it, if one person on the network decides to try and act by different rules, now the other players on the network look to them and say, well, you're not following what we all believe in as to how this network operates, so we're going to ignore, say, your transaction. Maybe you're trying to spend your same assets in two places. The network as a whole, the community looking at that would say, you're not following the proper procedures, so this transaction is void. Similarly, you can look at the network kind of one step above as far as regulation goes at a government level and say, you know, is this unregulated, or is this something that already fits into the regulation and compliance protocols that we have in place? Any legitimate exchange trying to act within the law knows that if they're touching fiat currencies, they have to follow KYC, AML, basic, you know, money service business compliance requirements, which didn't necessarily require a change in the written law. It's just an application of the law to new technology.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Back to the general terminology, what is a blockchain? What is that?
That's a fair question. So the Bitcoin blockchain, we'll start there, can be just seen as a big ledger. So a big, book of transactions. As the book moves forward, every 10 minutes or so in Bitcoin space, it's a new page added to that ledger saying, here are the transactions that took place over the last 10 minutes. We validated them all through the use of cryptography. And we've now added that page in, and now we're working on understanding what transactions will be in the next page. So you can kind of think of it as a big Excel document where we all know exactly what each other's balance is. We all have the exact same Excel document loaded locally, but as it changes throughout the globe, we're able to come to a general consensus of what that Excel document it looks like.
And I think from an accounting perspective, if people think of cryptocurrencies or blockchain and think it's all anonymous and it's all out in cyberspace and people are doing things on the black market or whatever it may be. And, to some extent, some of those things are true, but in reality, to have a public ledger that you can track transactions and you can see where money is flowing and certain behavioral things and things like that, there is comfort in that, knowing, if we have a case and somebody hands over their books to us in real time, non-cryptocurrency, I don't know that those books are real or fake. Did they just create them in Excel yesterday? There's no one to really verify. I mean, we can go in on the back end and look at, metadata and things like that, but that's a lot more intensive work. Whereas when you have a public general blockchain ledger that everyone's working, as the example Josh put out of a same Excel spreadsheet, having that comfort and that information is very valuable.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So maybe let's get into a little bit of a concrete example. I don't know, if someone came up to me and said, hey, I'll give you a Bitcoin for your car. I looked today. A Bitcoin is currently valued at above 8,000 euro or the equivalent of $10,000. I don't know. Maybe you guys have a better handle on if that's really accurate. But what does that transaction look like? What would I be receiving in return? What am I taking possession of when I give them my car? Is a transaction like that even possible today?
Yeah, it's absolutely possible.
Okay.
So the neat thing about cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin especially, you never actually hold a Bitcoin itself. Instead, so say on your computer or on your special Bitcoin wallet, you're not holding the coin within that, again, because we're just sharing a ledger. So instead, right, what you're holding is a secret, and that secret gives you the authority to change ownership of certain funds in that ledger. So what that transaction actually looks like under the hood of someone purchasing your car for Bitcoin is if they've got their wallet on their system. So again, that wallet is just a secret key.
Right.
They then create a transaction that says, let me step back a moment. You then provide them your address.
Right.
The address is an identifier found in your wallet.
Okay.
And that address is derived from that secret. So it's related to the secret. With the secret, you can figure out your address. But with your address, you can't go back and figure out your secret.
Mm-hmm.
And an address, although in Bitcoin, it's a very long string of numbers and letters. To simplify it, you can just think of it like an email address.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that, you can create on your own. And in this case, you would give it to this person who is purchasing your car. You would say, here's the address that you need to send the funds to. They would create a transaction sending, if your car happens to be $10,000 US or €8,000, they would be sending roughly one Bitcoin.
Right.
By creating a transaction for one Bitcoin to your address. They would then broadcast that transaction by clicking send in their app. And it would be sent to all the other nodes listening for transactions.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the community then is coming into play.
Exactly. So each person who receives this transaction is going to validate it themselves and then also progress it to the next nodes that they know about. That way, eventually, the entire network learns about this transaction. And through this, some of those nodes on the network are the miners, or the kind of keepers of the network, mm-hmm. who perform this key step.
And to bring it back to the blockchain itself, so now going forward, there is the transaction of the person who bought your car, his address, sending the one Bitcoin to your address within the blockchain. And then any transactions that happen within the overall network of Bitcoin after the fact will then be added again to that ledger that we talk about. But there's a specific transaction that's now locked in, you know, the chain for the future. So mm-hmm. that is now verified by the public network, and that is now available to anyone that wants to see that it took place. They probably don't know who you are based on your address, mm-hmm. but they can at least verify that that address had that account or that Bitcoin, and then it went to, you know, your new account, or your new address.
And from your perspective, if you're just looking at your phone, which has your Bitcoin wallet on it, hopefully in this example, mm-hmm. You would see that transaction get broadcast to the network. So you would see suddenly on your phone that you've got a pending one Bitcoin waiting. Mm-hmm. And then as the network validates that throughout, your phone would be able to show your confidence level in knowing that that person hasn't then tried to spend that same money elsewhere, maybe buying two cars at the same time in some sort of impressive situation.
Right.
So your phone would be... Again, your phone isn't being sent the coins directly, but your wallet would be a good indication that, or a good indicator of when you'd be able to hand over the keys. So it sounds really complicated, but if we take a step back and just assume how you would do a regular banking transaction in this case, where let's say they open up their phone, they open up their mobile banking application, and they just do a transfer from their account to your account, they would still need either your email address or your account number.
Right.
And then they would say, okay, well, I want to send, instead of saying one Bitcoin, they would say, I want to send $10,000.
Right.
That would eventually get moved over. The difference is they're broadcasting their desire to change, in this case, a central ledger in those banking systems, instead of a distributed ledger across all these community nodes.
Right. And what is the verification process like in terms of time for this Bitcoin transaction then for my car? I mean, is it a similar time as the verification process that we're experiencing now with banks?
It can be anywhere from, so you can see the transaction instantly.
Okay.
Just like you can see a credit card transaction instantly.
Mm-hmm.
And just as a credit card transaction then takes about 3 days to finalize, you see a Bitcoin transaction immediately, and then it could take anywhere between about an hour to become very concrete,
mm-hmm.
Or it might take a couple days depending on network congestion right now.
Mm-hmm.
But that's certainly something that people are working towards improving.
And anyone can have a Bitcoin or a cryptocurrency wallet?
Yeah, you can actually create an infinite number of wallets and addresses,
mm-hmm.
There's no central party that you go to create one of these. It's just about creating the secret key.
Mm-hmm.
So you can shuffle a deck of cards, write down each face you see, and you've made a cryptocurrency key.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, and so now I've then received my Bitcoin for my car. What are some of the risks associated with having this asset now in my wallet? Are there risks associated with it? Is it riskier than holding my $10,000 in the bank?
I mean, there's certainly, people see Bitcoin as a highly volatile currency. So there's certainly risk that the $10,000 you received.
Right.
Lowers down to 9,000 or goes down to zero. It could also increase. It's also a risk if you say if on your phone, and you lose your phone, or your phone breaks, or your phone is compromised,
okay,
then it's possible you could lose that as well. There's certainly measures to prevent that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a while ago, if you received a Bitcoin, the ability for you to then convert that Bitcoin to cash or other things or use it, probably had less access than you do today.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, it's almost the equivalent in the United States of having a Discover card. Not everyone takes it.
Mm-hmm.
But now, Bitcoin, it's almost like having a Visa or MasterCard. It's really kind of taken a lot everywhere, and you can kind of exchange it across exchanges to get cash or something that is usable. So I think a lot of those risks of potential usability are gone. And really now the risks is like anything else. If you trade your car for Apple stock, there's a volatility.
Right.
It's going to go up or down and so forth. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I would have the option then, after receiving this Bitcoin, of tomorrow, say the value of the Bitcoin went up, I could just have a pretty good chance of getting rid of that asset then right away, or make a purchase with it then.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're comfortable, the interesting thing about this scenario is that you'd be comfortable enough, you'd trust Bitcoin enough,
mm-hmm,
to sell your car for it. So you see that there's value in transferring it for goods and services, which means hopefully others in the community see that same value. So, maybe you have to turn around and you need some work done on your home and you'd like to pay a contractor, and you find a contractor who's willing, or perhaps you find a piece of art that you like and they're willing to take cryptocurrency.
Mm-hmm.
So it does eventually, a network effect does grow. There's certainly a common way is to just go to an exchange, put your Bitcoin on an exchange, sell it, and then with what you've sold it for on that exchange to USD or Euro or whatever your local currency is,
mm-hmm,
get that transferred into your bank account. It's certainly possible. There's friction in that movement. It would be better just to use the currency,
mm-hmm,
locally for other transactions, but both are possible.
And volume a little bit matters here as well. With one Bitcoin, you're probably not going to have big issues with moving things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But if all of a sudden someone tries to sell, 50,000 Bitcoins on the market, like anything else, why is someone selling this asset? Is there a problem? You might raise a red flag or something like
right.
that. So you see that, if you're going to try to unload a large volume, you want to do it either piecemeal or through different channels or things like that, because it's an asset. So anytime anyone looks to sell a large, large quantity, it is going to have an effect on the market. But, when you're in your scenario of one Bitcoin, that's pretty easy to unload on the exchanges. So,
mm-hmm. So I guess a lot of it is really based on trust in the system then. I'm definitely starting to understand a little bit more about how it works. So say I want to now set up an account or an address that we talked about. What is the safest way to go about doing so? If I want to possess some of these assets, what's the safest way to go about doing so?
That's an excellent question. I'd mentioned using your phone as a wallet,
mm-hmm,
using your computer as a wallet. These are all options, but they're not necessarily the most secure options.
Mm-hmm.
There's devices and strategies out there that are far more secure, and they really center around one main concept, that private portion that we talked about, that special key, needs to never be on a device that's connected to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there's websites out there that'll help you set up a wallet, and many of them are very respectable.
Mm-hmm.
But the best, most secure way is done offline. So it could be something as simple as a series of words that you've written down on a piece of paper, or a computer that you've gone to the extreme and ripped out, the Wi-Fi card on it and the Bluetooth card on it.
Mm-hmm.
There's also specialized devices that hold the key for you, and then your computer can talk to that device,
mm-hmm,
to sign transactions. Now, that's getting complicated, I will admit that, but the key here is that there's different levels. I don't think having a wallet on your phone is necessarily bad. maybe you don't want to hold one Bitcoin on it, but consider it just like the wallet you hold in your pocket. Mm-hmm. You're not going to carry your life savings in that wallet, because if you accidentally leave that wallet on a table somewhere, then that those funds could be gone. Similarly, it's okay to have wallets on the internet, on your computer, on your phone, but you don't want to hold massive amounts of data there or massive amounts of crypto there. You just want to hold what you're using in your day-to-day, which is fluctuating depending on the person, of course.
Right. Okay. Getting back a little bit maybe to the technical side of things and understanding the public ledger, what can you guys add to that? I mean, how are these assets really being traced on blockchain?
Yeah, so when you have any type of regular ledger, you know, from the accounting perspective, mm-hmm. The general terms are debits and credits. And you know, if I use cash for a transaction to someone, then you know, I have a vendor that is on the other side of it, and I would record that in my company's transaction and ledger, you know, and you're accounting for your revenue and expenses. On a public ledger, you're just looking at the transactions themselves. So you are going to see the address of the person who sent the crypto to the address of the person who received it. Mm-hmm. Again, you don't know if an address is the only address that person has, or one person could have multiple addresses, so who knows if they're sending money to themselves. But again, it's verifiable. It's locked in. I can download that public ledger, mm-hmm. and look at the historical value. I can trace a coin that you might have in your wallet today. I can trace it back to the original origin when it was mined. You know, when it actually came out, and then how it got transferred across all the addresses to today. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, having that ability, I know it's anonymous when you're looking at the ledger in terms of just addresses. But if anyone tries to move those, you know, for Bitcoin, for example, across an exchange, a public exchange, mm-hmm. normally you need, you know, a name, a driver's license number or something like that to register with an exchange. And if there was any reason you had to freeze or trace an asset, you would be able to do it on the exchange level. But you'd be able to track a certain coin as far back or as far forward as you want it to go from today, because that information is all public.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think one thing to clarify here, too, is people see Bitcoin and think $10,000 per one Bitcoin. You actually, the smallest denomination of a Bitcoin is 100 millionth of a one Bitcoin. So uh-huh. It's 0.00000001 Bitcoins. Uh-huh. And the smallest amount you can transact is 5,280 of those smaller units. So I could send someone, you know, $1 worth of Bitcoin. It would just, uh-huh. you know, 0.0001 Bitcoins.
Oh, so
I'd be able to do that.
So it's not too late to get involved.
It is not at all. No, there's you can go to the 100 millionth of the current value is one individual technically transferable Bitcoin.
Okay. Uh-huh. I think the biggest concern for people, of course, is in this space is getting ripped off, right? And Bitcoin is not the only cryptocurrency out there. And it seems to be, I just read an article not too long ago about the city of Berkeley creating its own cryptocurrency. Article came out this week, a commodity shipper seeking, $150 million to start a digital coin of its own to speed up these bulk freight settlements. And can anyone create a coin? And if that's the case, doesn't it kind of hurt the credibility of the whole thing? Is there danger for fraudulent initial coin offerings? Kind of a big question, but...
First of all, yes, anyone at all can create a coin.
Okay.
There are thousands of cryptocurrencies, if mm-hmm. not tens of thousands now at this point.
Wow.
So it's not unusual for there to be a lot out there, which does provide a large landscape for potential for fraud. On the other hand, it's not always malice that has caused people to lose their coins. Sometimes it's unfortunately, on the incompetent side of the matter, mm-hmm. if a business thinks they've got a great service, but they don't take security seriously, then they can easily you know, lose their coins as quickly as a theft can happen.
Mm-hmm.
To take a step back, yes, anyone can create a cryptocurrency, but this space is about whether or not people see value in that project. So there's a lot of very, very good projects out there, and I don't even want to use the word competing against Bitcoin, because they're trying to bring a different perspective to it. They're trying to bring a different feature set to it. In fact, the Bitcoin protocol itself, those standards and procedures that everyone in the community agrees upon, those are very, very difficult to change. And we've seen that over the last couple of years, because you have to convince everyone that the idea has merit, that the idea is good for the coin, and that the idea won't cause problems, be it security or problems for specific countries. That then prevents Bitcoin itself from evolving quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes a lot of sense that other coins kind of show up and test out new ideas and new features on this landscape. It's not just about a distributed ledger. It's about, you know, the minutiae details about those rules in which that community acts upon. So by creating new coins, it does give us the ability globally to test out new ideas, see what works. It's possible that some of those ideas bubble up into Bitcoin. But through this process, these other projects end up gaining value all of its own. And people gain trust in the people working on it and trust in the assets themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So now, unfortunately, that does... It is very difficult as someone new coming into the space and not fully appreciating the history of each of these projects or the people behind them. There's certainly a lot of risk there. And it's still a very risky space if you're looking at it from an investment standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly won't deny that.
Mm-hmm. So back to the fraudulent initial coin offerings, are there some examples that maybe some things that people should keep their, or businesses should keep their eyes out for? Or should people just stick to Bitcoin?
I think the common idiom the common saying of if it's too good to be true,
yeah.
It probably is.
Yeah.
It is very, very important here. If a project is any ICO that's guaranteeing returns,
right?
I don't think has any value in the space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the original reason that Bitcoin was set up was for the peer-to-peer transactions in a network, not 20% returns that we see, you know, promised in the normal Ponzi scheme pitch that I come across in a lot of our investigative matters.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's kind of a red flag to look for. But there was one was just shut down recently in January. If you want to talk about that, Josh?
Sure. So one that is getting a lot of press is one called BitConnect.
Mm-hmm.
And BitConnect sold, you know, material on how to work with BitConnect and kind of a classic multi-level marketing kind of business. But then, you know, through their investor presentations and events, they would get up on stage and tout how easy it is to make money and the returns that they're getting are incredible and yada, yada, yada. It was also interesting that their kind of exchange ticker, they used BCC, which is very close to some other important tickers. So a way to kind of encourage confusion into buying that asset instead of maybe what you should be buying on the network. And it was, unfortunately, a lot of the times people in the community leaders in the community will be very open about their concern about companies like this. Mm-hmm. BitConnect had many, many people come out and say that there was worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't stop people from investing. And then unfortunately it was shut down. And honestly, even after the company itself was kind of, at least this all came to light, the token that these people had sold was even still trading on certain exchanges and trading at, say, a value of $5. Mm-hmm. So here's something where, you know, it's been recognize that it's a scam, or at least they're certainly going through the legal motions of proving that they're not. But people in the industry, but there's still, you know, their own little sub-community that is trying to keep it going. So it's a very difficult thing to seed out, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Maybe one thing to talk about, Josh, is we always talk about blockchain and Bitcoin here, and the necessity of a blockchain to have a cryptocurrency or not, and if a cryptocurrency does not have a blockchain or something that they want to log the ledger, could that be a red flag for a fraudulent coin or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. That was another common one from a couple of years ago was OneCoin. And OneCoin promised that was basically another MLM showing people how to invest, teaching people how to invest, but into the OneCoin platform. And through this, you would earn OneCoin, which is their coin. And they touted this as a cryptocurrency. But if you went through their site, there is no actual mechanism to download a local client and download a local copy of that ledger. It simply wasn't there. So it ended up being, in their case, a centralized database where they just held the records of the accounts of everyone and changed those manually in the back end for them, which gave them the ability to, you know, get up on stage and congratulate everyone as they just doubled everyone's money. Mm-hmm. And they literally go in and just multiply everyone's account balance by two, and everyone's thrilled.
Right.
Is it necessary to have a blockchain to have a cryptocurrency? Or the majority of the reputable ones do?
Yes. It's pretty common for people to say, I like this blockchain idea, but Bitcoin I don't agree with. The thing about these networks is that even if it's not a currency being transferred back and forth, which in Bitcoin's case it is, and that's also a reward for how the network is validated. And another example, Ethereum, and Ethereum is basically trying to be the world's computer. Mm-hmm. In that, the currency known as ETH or Ether is also the fuel for how you basically buy time on that world computer. So in that case, it's a blockchain with a focus not necessarily purely on finance, like Bitcoin, of transferring assets back and forth. It's raw computing power, but even in that raw computing power, it's still important to have that token to transfer back and forth as what powers the network and what incentivizes people to work across that network.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I mean, going back to schemes, some people are more than happy to be involved in schemes. Mm-hmm. There's one example on this Ethereum network, this world computer, where someone created an application that's out there in the wild, which is just literally a Ponzi scheme.
Mm-hmm.
Like it has no, it's not trying to, I guess, scam people in a way, but it's being very, very outward that this is in fact a Ponzi scheme. If you put money in and other people come in after you, you will then get money. Mm-hmm. So you're encouraged to try and get people to put money in. But the structure of the code is just a couple lines of code, and it's just a distributed Ponzi scheme, which some people are fine to interact with, despite knowing exactly what it is.
Okay. So maybe moving, I mean, we had just talked a little bit about blockchains not necessarily being involved with coins. Do you see cryptocurrencies aside, what are some other potential applications for blockchain technology? Can it be helpful in other industries?
Yeah, I mean, one that always comes to mind for me is, looking at a food. Anytime where you have for lack of a better term, a chain, everyone's all about when you go to restaurants, farm to table, and those kind of things. And when you go to the grocery store, people are looking at ingredients and things like that. And where did it come from? Was it irradiated or not? Things like that. I know in certain countries you can't use irradiation, in certain ones you can. And when you look at that, you go, okay, what if there was a public ledger, a public chain that logged where everything came from? And when I scanned a label, I could get the entire history of something, and it wasn't manipulated. It couldn't be manipulated. It was public information. And that chain could log all that information. I think that's very valuable in a lot of supply chain stuff too.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We see similar in the diamond industry as well.
Mm-hmm.
Other examples, countries are looking at e-passports or e-citizenship, where your identity is basically tied to the actions taking place on certain blockchains, which is interesting mm-hmm. for bringing in kind of more foreign interest to those countries without necessarily giving them all the rights that a regular citizen would have. You know, you don't have to give these people healthcare, you just have to give them access to, you know, build businesses without being there locally. So
mm-hmm.
The other one you're seeing right now that's building huge momentum is in the gaming industries.
Mm-hmm.
Both in the gambling sense and in skill-based gaming as well. Mm-hmm. It's been a very interesting development. You're seeing a lot of global gambling or online gambling shops certainly move towards this technology as there's a lot less friction in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then gaming is another interesting aspect because they're not trying to develop currencies using the blockchain. They're trying to store assets. So if I'm in one game and I win a big sword, I can then move over to, you know, this other game that supports that same asset because I've held that asset. So even if the game is from a completely different company, if they recognize it, then I can bring that in, which obviously brings in a lot of elements of trading those assets, be it for other assets or for other cryptocurrencies.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I got a couple more questions, and then we'll wrap it up. But one kind of going all the way back to the beginning where I used the example of my car. Is that a transaction that you guys would feel comfortable doing? Would you, depending on your car, of course, maybe we need 2 Bitcoins, I don't know, 1 Bitcoin, whatever, however many Bitcoins, would you be open for that transaction?
Personally, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in cryptocurrencies, as I said, for a number of years, and through those years, I've felt it's important to use those back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
I've been involved in a number of businesses that paid developers, that paid legal professionals, marketers, designers, all sorts of different professions in cryptocurrency. And those businesses that were working with those consultants or advisors received those cryptocurrencies from their clients. So I've seen firsthand, you know, a network of people that are willing to work within these with these assets.
Mm-hmm.
I would actually prefer if someone gave me cryptocurrency for my car over the dollar, just because that would be it's easier to me than finding exchange, depositing money, and buying it, because then I'm paying certain fees.
Mm-hmm.
I would have no problem. As the risk-averse accountant, I'm usually the last to take a chance on something like that. But in for the work that we do, we've seen too many legitimate businesses and sources use this stuff regularly and interact with it to say you can't trust it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if someone were to say, hey, I want to do this, I want to have my car, I'd like to give you Bitcoin for your car, I wouldn't go, my old, you know, 2 years ago, I might have said, why wouldn't he just give me cash? That makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now I kind of understand the reasons behind it, why people have it, why the network exists, and say, okay, that, yeah, that sounds great. You know, how do you want to, you know, what price are we going to work with? Rather than my first thought would be to jump to, this seems odd. It, you know, it doesn't anymore because of kind of the network that's been built.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'd like to wrap it up with predictions, a look in the future, maybe. Where will cryptocurrency and where will blockchain technology be in 5 years? And follow up, will Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies largely replace traditional currencies?
5 years, long time in the crypto world.
Okay, we can even talk about 2020, maybe. It's
regular. Fiat currency, government currencies are not going anywhere.
Right.
I don't see that happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think you'll see more and more governments comfortable with issuing a version of their own currency on top of blockchain technology,
mm-hmm.
giving people the ability to move that in a quick digital manner. Digital payments are certainly nothing new to the general public. And I think you'll see governments and organizations appreciating how quick and easy these can be to use when done right. Mm-hmm. But I think you will also see over the next couple of years more growing pains, more companies who don't take security seriously and unfortunately are on the incompetent side of the matter. Mm-hmm. And of course, you will see more companies on the malicious side of the matter as well, unfortunately trying to take advantage of their customers and trying to take advantage of the fact that this technology is there's no undue. So once they have those funds, then they're able to do so.
Mm-hmm. I think it's here to stay. As you know, one of the old adages, you know, the consumer's always right, and I think the consumers drive where we go. You know, 10, 15 years ago, you know, people are having to pay for checking accounts or things like that, and all of a sudden the people said, "Why am I paying for this?" And all of a sudden everyone goes, "Oh, I get a free checking account." And so people are going to eventually say, "Well, I don't want my check to have to take 5 days to clear because of a minimum balance rule or things like that. I want it to be done in 10 minutes or an hour. I want it to be done digitally." And as banks are going to have to keep up with that, they're going to have to either verify times, which when you have different banks, if you don't have a public ledger or a chain to do so, you're going to have issues there. So I think the technology is going to be utilized. I think Bank of America actually owns 43 patents with the word blockchain involved within them already, and that they filed that they are, you know, in the process. So I think everyone's ready for it. Like anything else, you know, one news story hits and everybody takes, you know, 10 steps back on a hack that occurred or something that may happen. But I think that's the kind of the route we're going. You know, every time you look at healthcare and public records, if we see one digital breach on, you know, a medical record, people freak out and say, "I'm never going to store my information on the cloud." I don't think anyone will argue that in 15 years it'll all be on the cloud. It's just going to, every time something comes up, it's a little bit slower, a little bit tougher to get over those speed bumps. Mm-hmm. So it's just going to be how the media stories respond when a negative press happens on how quickly we adapt it, I think.
All right. Well, Jeff, Josh, thank you for taking the time to share your knowledge in this space. And I wish you all the best in your future investigations and cryptocurrency endeavors. And thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's great.
All right. That wraps up episode 3 of Buzz IT Talk. If you have any questions for Jeff and Josh, feel free to comment on our episode page at buzzittalk.com or reach out on LinkedIn. I have included links to their profiles also on the episode page. If you're interested in sharing your insights on one of the many tech buzzwords, feel free to contact me at buzzittalk@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in.